government ending a lockdown right now is like telling people at a beach they can go back in the water, but the shark's still out there. Some people will go in. The economy will partly reopen, but it's not going to be the same.
I think you can expect that these are permanent moves. More and more people are going to work from home. Mark Zuckerberg announced that Facebook's going to be a 50-50 probably within the next few years. I imagine it'll be faster and even more. More and more companies do. Dell announced something. Google announced they're going to keep everybody home until the end of the year, just about. So it's just a wave that's coming through, and I think it's going to be really hard to suck that wave back.
The new legislation would tackle secession, subversion, terrorism, foreign interference. It would set up Beijing-backed intelligence agencies. The Secretary of State, Mike Pompeo, has issued a statement condemning what he says the U.S. believes is unilateral action on the part of China that is disastrous, he said, and would be the death knell of Hong Kong's autonomy.
What Beijing says is that this is a very standard security law that would help safeguard the territorial integrity of China. They say other countries have similar laws, but the way it's been received in Hong Kong and internationally as well speaks to the level of anger and the concern about what this law could be used for.
This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team.
Well, the economic stats keep getting worse. As we have warned here on the program, unemployment claims rose by 2.4 million in the latest week. Jobless claims rose in all 50 states, according to the government, with several states now experiencing unemployment rates well over 20%. At the top of the list is Nevada with a 28.2% unemployment rate. We are seeing unemployment jump to levels not seen since the Great Depression. Hospitality, as you can imagine, and leisure have been hit the hardest with a 50% drop. Next to that is manufacturing. Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplava, and welcome to a special edition of the Financial Sense News Hour. Today's show will feature a roundtable discussion on the gold and silver markets. Joining me for that discussion will be Jeff Christian from the CPM Group and Dave Morgan from the Morgan Report. We're going to discuss the drivers of precious metals markets and why you should own gold and metals in your portfolio. Basil Chapman will join me with a bullish projection for the Dow Industrials, which have lagged the technology stocks. But for the short run, Basil thinks we're likely to remain in a trading range until things begin to clear up on the economic front or the virus. But before we do that, let's find out what moved this week's markets with Ryan Poplava.
Thanks, Jim. And the main catalyst this week came from promising vaccine data from Moderna's regarding its vaccine for COVID-19 during its phase one study over the weekend. News of the data came right after Fed Chair Powell told 60 Minutes that it would take a year for the economy to recover and that it would take a vaccine. So investors connected the dots on Monday between Moderna's news and Powell's 60 Minute interview. But besides the U.S. stock market being up, the main piece of news here was the amazing performance of the areas trashed the most by COVID-19, including leisure, energy, hotels, and banks. And I especially like Jonathan Krinsky's subject line for one of his pieces titled Dash for Trash. Shorts were definitely getting squeezed in those areas, and these are areas that have been hit the most by COVID-19 and stand to benefit the most, I think, from a vaccine trade in addition to any biotech that releases said vaccine. You know, some of the best performing industry groups I have been tracking this week were construction, airlines, energy service, housing, leisure and entertainment, and regional banks. Areas at the bottom of the list were the areas that had already had great performance since the March bottom, like cloud, retail, software, and semiconductors, mainly tech here, and select retailers that have benefited from hoarding of toilet paper. Mainly, you know, I think looking into this, that profit taking was probably likely happening in these areas that have already run up really nicely and maybe allowing for that rotation into the industries trashed by the coronavirus. The other main catalyst this week I'd like to focus on is the national security law China's parliament is proposing and will vote on towards the end of this month. It's kicking up democratic protests again in Hong Kong and stressing the U.S., who wants to see freedoms respected, and especially regarding that original agreement to see China take over sovereignty of Hong Kong. The proposed law would be even stronger than Article 23, which was proposed and shelved in 2003 due to mass marching and protesting. The current law, according to an article I read on CNN, would criminalize treason, secession, sedition, and subversion against the central government, and would allow Chinese national security personnel to fulfill relevant duties to safeguard said national security in accordance with the law. So Hong Kong citizens are scared that essentially they're going to begin seeing arbitrary punishment, secret detention, and political prosecution that has been prevalent in China. They're scared that this would now be seen in Hong Kong. And to be honest, there are examples of that happening in Hong Kong since all the protests from last year. The issue as it relates to the financial markets is the increased tension it brings between foreign powers to protect Hong Kong citizens from these threats. And some of that came from recently Trump, who promised a strong reaction by the U.S. if it's passed. And then Congress, there were some officials that said they're thinking about increased sanctions. And the other issue with all this is the instability this is causing in the financial market. So if we look at the Hong Kong Hang Seng, it was down 5.5% on Friday. And that just affects many emerging market funds and ETFs that are holding investments in China and in Asia. If you have a lot of exposure to Asian investments, this could be a risk you need to watch very closely here in the next week, because I believe it's going to be voted on, I think, May 28th. U.S. futures were down initially on the news, but Dr. Fauci gave an opinion about Moderna's results, saying that he's cautiously optimistic, and that helped U.S. stocks recover on Friday, in addition to, I think, earnings from NVIDIA. Moderna CEO told Fox Business about midweek that the vaccine has been cleared to go into phase two trials by the FDA. So the very, very good news on the vaccine front this week, and that's what's largely led to the successful move in stocks. It was a normal week, and the economic news continued to be interpreted as either so bad it can only get better, like in the housing starts, which dropped 25% in April, or we're dealing with this is less bad than before, as in the Home Builder Confidence Index, which was up 7 points, still down significantly in negative territory. Then there was also unemployment claims, which there was an additional 2.2 million, but that was down, again, less than the addition we saw last week. And then finally, there was an uptick in the Philadelphia Fed survey for May, showing manufacturing in that region has ticked up, still down, and negative 43 from a negative 56. So still, all three of those items still very bad in the deeply negative levels, but less bad than previously. And so that's helping restore some confidence. On the plus side, beyond all the negative economic news, there was several companies that reported earnings or reported conditions that are improving as the economy reopens. So, for example, that's NVIDIA, Deer. Starbucks said it's rolling out its openings much faster and getting better results. TGX and company, the clothing company, Analog Devices, and then Facebook announced its shop programs to help businesses go online on Facebook as well as Instagram. And a nice beat from Walmart as well. And I'd like to talk a little bit about that. There were a number of phase two goods. Let's talk about phase two of the market reopening. Phase one was quick quarantine, batten down the hatches, buy all the toilet paper you can because it's going out of stock, as well as cleaners. But phase two goods have been adult bicycles, video games, things to do while you're quarantined to entertain or, you know, participate with the family. So a lot of those sales kicked up. Overall, e-commerce sales grew 74% as all segments grew, including store pickup, ship to home, and ship from store. That's pretty much it from this week. Next week, again, I think the focus is going to be squarely on Hong Kong and what's going on there between it and China. Focus in on that, follow that, and mitigate the risk if you need to. I know we'll be looking at it very closely. Jim, back to you for the technical report.
Back in February, just a day before the S&P 500 hit a new all-time high, Variant Perceptions' Tian Yang told listeners that the consensus view on COVID-19 was way too optimistic, and that investors should scale back on stocks and wait for a virus-induced sell-off to buy back in. Again, that was right as the stock market was hitting all-time highs, and only a matter of weeks before the consensus view radically changed in that direction. FS Insider caught up with Tian Yang this week to get an update on his outlook to talk about the stock market, the economy, commodities, geopolitical risk, and a wide range of other areas. Here's a portion of what he told listeners when we asked him about his outlook on the commodity sector.
I think the reason why a lot of investors don't feel very comfortable with the current market crash and rebound is that we've probably not seen as many of the usual washout bottom liquidation events or kind of true dislocations that you historically have seen at major market bottoms. Obviously, we've seen some, so things like negative oil prices, and these are actually probably quite good signs that we might finally be at a point where energy is, you know, is truly going to wash out, and there's going to be some corrective mechanisms kicking in. Obviously, this is going to be supportive for crude oil and that whole kind of complex. But perhaps across kind of asset class as a whole, you've not seen the same kind of, you know, true dislocation kind of event, right? Like Russia defaulting, Lehman Brothers going under. And obviously, because central banks everywhere have turned on the printing presses, obviously they're trying to prevent that, and it's active policy to prevent it. So I think that's probably why this time around, it feels quite uncomfortable. But I think for commodities, the next marginal move will probably be more fiscal stimulus from China and the US.
To hear this full interview, in addition to our three interviews airing every week on FS Insider through our website or through a podcast app on your mobile device, go to financialsense.com and hit the subscribe button.
Do you dream about throwing out the alarm clock so you can travel, enjoy your hobbies, or just relax? You've worked hard for decades and want to cash in on all that hard work. Now it's time to develop a plan that can help you get there. Give Financial Sense Wealth Management a call today to get your retirement plan started. We can help to make sure you have the income you need to live the lifestyle you want, how to maximize government benefits from Social Security to Medicare, reduce taxes and plan for future inflation, or protect your assets with an estate plan. Don't leave your retirement up to chance. Contact Financial Sense Wealth Management today at 888-486-3939 or email us at grow@financialsense.com.
Well, stocks are getting a little bit of a lift. Seems like we've been in a sideways trading pattern here over the last month. Where do we go forward? Will we hit a summer rally, or is it that old saying, sell in May, go away, come back after Labor Day? Joining us on the program is Basil Chapman. Basil, as you look at the charts, let's begin with the major indexes. We've got the NASDAQ, which seems to be on fire and seems to be leading the rest of the pack. What's your take?
So a couple of things. And this is actually, you nailed it right at your opening statement. You said sideways move. And if we look at the April, let's just take the Dow for a moment. If we take the high of the, this is the candle of the 9th of April, the Dow's at 24,008. We've been in a sideways move. We've been up to 24,764. We've been down to 22,789. We're at the upper end of this move right now. So this is a perfect time to either start to see a break up to the 25,000s, or we start to move below 24,000, and that says, uh-oh, be careful, we've got a consolidation. So that's the Dow. Now, your question about the NDX 100, the QQQ, that, of course, is a completely different animal entirely. That is really the, if you had pulled a Rip Van Winkle here and you went to sleep on February the 6th and you said, I'm not worrying about the internet, I'm not listening to the news, I'm not looking at the news, I'm just going to have a sleep for about 2 months or so. And you woke up today, so you leave when the QQQs are in the monthly chart, February of 2020, you're at 237, and you come back today, and it's at 228, hit a high today of 232, 5 to 9 points off the all-time high, and you say, ho-hum, what a nice sleep. What happened? You don't know. You don't know there was a 39% decline in the Dow. There was a 30% decline in the QQQs down to 164.93 the week of the 27th of March. And now you're back. That's a V-shaped recovery. If you remember the December 2018 low, when we came back very quickly then, not as quick as this, but we came back quickly, there were some charts that made V-shaped patterns in the weekly and monthly charts. And they went, where did they go to? They went right back. Some of them within a dollar of their previous highs. So that's really the template that I'm looking at here, that the high of 237.47 in the NDX 100 trading vehicle, the Invesco QQQ Trust Series, that's a target. But in my work, if we break even one penny above 237.47, that essentially triggers in my weekly chart a buy mode that says you should go to at least four subsequent highs. So you've four highs altogether. So you've made a low at 164. You've gone to a peak A. That's your first peak where you make a little curve and you make a lower high the next week. So that was at 216 on the week of the 17th of April. It pulls back for just the moment. It actually hits the 9-period exponential moving average and then soars higher. And what does it do? It goes to this week high of 231.76 leg B. So if we, in this move, either in this leg B, or pull back a little bit and then make a higher high in the weekly chart above 230, let's call it 238, to me, that's saying that in 2020, we should go even higher. And that almost implies the same thing with a monthly chart. And yet you've got something very different in the Dow, the S&P, and the IWM, the Russell 2000. This is a perfect time to be looking at these because we're bumping into a lot of resistance. A lot of the NDX 100 leaders have been soaring higher, and some of them are just beginning to get into what I would call resistance zones.
Yeah, when we take a look at the major indexes, the one thing that's really stood out, as you mentioned, the Qs and the NASDAQ. The NASDAQ looks like it's approaching its former high. It's well above its 200-day and 50-day moving averages. And yet, Basil, when you look at the S&P, it got up to its 200-day, and it seems to be large resistance at that area as it pulls back from that. Same thing when you look at the Dow, or even if you look at the Dow Utilities, which looks even worse.
So we're really talking about vastly different sector scenarios when you add the utilities. But what's interesting is that even with this very big move up, remember the utilities were moving up in concert with the market. That was kind of unusual, right up to the high that was made in the utilities. That went, the XLU went to about 71 in February and then pulled back. I mean, for a utility company to go from the 70s down to a low of 43, I mean, we're talking about bonds and utilities acting like stocks. They never normally, this doesn't happen normally. So this is very unusual.
You know, when you take a look at some of these indexes, you know, they have these V-shaped recoveries, a steep fall off and a steep comeback. And I don't care if you're looking at even the oil markets, which fell off a cliff and now seem to be coming back sharply. Have you ever seen in your career something happen this quick, this steep, and come back this fast? I would have, Basil, the only thing I can recall was 1987 when we had, what, a 30, 33, 35?
But that took 18 months to go back to the new high. Remember that October 19th at the low, it took a year and a half, but we did get back to all-time highs. This, you're absolutely, so isn't this very representative of the age we're in, the age of speed, where within a split second you can hear what's going on 9,000 miles away, in fact, up in space? So I think what we're looking at here is the condensation of time through the, and that's one of the reasons why I think you've got the leadership in the QQQ and the Index 100, because I was mentioning this on my show, my daily show that I have on TFNN, that what we're really looking at here is a microcosm of what used to take a very long time. And we've just had basically in any other period, if you spoke about what happened in terms of the joblessness, the speed with which we've hit numbers that we haven't even seen till, you know, back in the 1930s, look how quickly that happened. But it might also mean now the QQQ and the even the speed with which we've gotten back in some sectors that you would normally not expect. Perhaps what it's saying is the condensation of the climax. And to this, I'm going to show on the chart when you display all the charts that I have. The TVIX, which normally trades, this is the 2x long volatility. I mention this because being 2x long, it means that you've got players here that are prepared to take a little bit more of a gamble than 1-to-1 on something as volatile as this. Normally trading in the 38s, hit a round number. I love to look at round numbers. Hit a round number high of 1,000.00. I don't know how they do that. On the 18th of March, that was the Friday before the Monday low in the market. And if you put everything together, if you had to Google coronavirus, recession, whatever you wanted, I'm sure that in Google it would have had this huge spike in the concern of everyone going to their, looking and trying to reap as much information as they could. And that's what you saw on that day. So I think that condensation is, I mean, going from the 38s just a few weeks before to 1,000 of this TVIX volatility index, I think that kind of sums it up in many ways. And that's why I think the QQQs might be saying, hey, we have leadership because we are 21st century stocks. We're using communications better than ever before. And those old bricks and mortars, that crowd, they're hanging on, but we're the leaders. And maybe that's what it's saying, so that we're looking at a dichotomy, a tale of two cities here between the old and the new. And maybe this is the compact, this is the spring-loaded compact visual representation that we're looking at. Right now, when you get a V-shape, as I said, if you went to sleep in early February and you woke up now, you'd say, hey, what's going on? And yet, look what happened.
Yeah, that's amazing, too, because when you consider the first 2 weeks of February, the unemployment rate was the lowest in 60 years. The indexes, all of them, were at major all-time record highs. You go back 3 months later, we're at unemployment rates that we haven't seen since the Great Depression. And we also compressed, in a short period of time, almost a 40% decline in your major indexes. I mean, all of that, Basil, in just a period of a couple of months.
Has never been seen before. Now, but this is the other thing. And I think that this kind of, in a nutshell, I think for me, sums it. Took me a little while to figure out just exactly what's going on. Then when I realized, I have these books, I have dozens of books on the 1929 top and the crash. You name it and I've read it. I've even got microfiche from way back in the 80s when I was studying it, when I went to the Boston Library to get everything I could to find out about what happened. Well, all of the 1987 crash, the 2008-2009 crash, the 2000.com bubble, every time it's been an economic excessiveness. Something happened that took us to levels that we've never seen before, where in 1929, you got the Empire State Building, the papers were signed in the summer of 1929, people were sitting at the brokerage houses watching the ticker. I had spoken to you about this months ago, and I said, Jim, has anybody come up to you to talk to you about the great stocks that they've bought and how much money they're making, and yet the market's moving to all-time highs? This has been the most silent bull market I have ever come across. And I think that what we've seen here is a medical phenomenon and not the usual banks at tops, brokerage houses making tops, people talking about stocks everywhere you go. I remember in 2000, I remember playing tennis, and even at the tennis club, they had this big monitor that was showing you the market. In the gym, wherever you went, everyone had CNBC on. You don't see that today. So I think this is an aborted major market rally, and I only hope that I'm correct in the sense that although it's very difficult and it's just horrible for people who are out of work, somehow or other, in the months to come, things are repaired and we get back and get on track again. Because, as I say, I didn't see it as a financial crash. Now it is turning into something like that. But it was a medical issue. It was something that came across as a pandemic. February, the unemployment rates were phenomenal. And even for people who are very skeptical and they say, you can be as skeptical as you want. A 60-year low is a 60-year low, and it happens to impact every group that you want to be bettered by the low unemployment. So,
Is probably, Basil, the first almost depression that was basically government induced. In the past, when we had overheating economies, we had a stock market bubble, a real estate bubble, the Fed was raising interest rates. This was a deliberate government shutdown of the economy. And I want to talk about this crazy market that we're seeing compressed in time. How much of this also has to do with what the Fed is doing? I mean, Basil, if you had $1 million right now, and you put it in a treasury note, and you were living off income on $1 million, all you
would... Wait, what income?
Yeah.
What income?
Can you imagine getting less than $1,500 interest on $1 million portfolio?
Well, you've got to make a very good point, but I remember when everyone was talking about the sort of elitism of people, I said the people that are the most protected are government workers, people who are getting a fixed when they retire, they're going to get a pension that is based on other factors. But not many people realize that to get the kind of income that some people would live on, let's just say $60,000. Do you know how much money you have to save to get just the tax-free income on that without risk? You'd have to have a lot of money saved away just to get a very safe income. And those were the people, that was the select few that we should have been talking about. So I think that you're absolutely right. No, something's wrong with this picture, and it's not going to unfold very easily. So when you talk about the summer, I think we're in for some choppy times. No, that's an easy thing to say. We're always in for choppy times. But I think what we need to do is just make it very specific. If the Dow starts, the Dow, I'm saying because this is the Dow 30, which is not the Dow Industrials, it's really 30 stocks. And I like the mix of the Dow very much right now. It has every single field. It's got everything you want in it, but it's not industrials. So if the Dow gets to 25,200, I think we've broken out into new territory. That might push the QQQs up. But my thinking here is that we might get a rotational correction as the semiconductors, which kind of lead the way. I think they're going to take a bit of a breather. I think the Qs, many of the stocks in the QQQs, are right at levels that I think they're really reaching, so they can have a pullback. And this is the period where we're going to see, will the Russell 2000, the IWM, will money come out of the high techs and say, you know what, these are looking very attractive for this particular period, and maybe we'll see a rotation where we don't have to smash to the downside, because the low that was made on March the 23rd, that TVIX, that volatility index, I don't know what it would take to get the whole mood of, it wasn't the country, it was the world at that particular time in absolute hysteria. So I'm thinking that we could have a rotational correction. And at that particular time, you're going to find some of the stocks that were just the fuddy-duddies actually are doing very nicely. And maybe we do have that pullback. So maybe we have summer doldrums in some sectors that were on fire up until now. And the stocks that were just kind of hanging around start to move better. But when you look at the rental companies, when you look at the cruise lines, when you look at the airlines, this is tough stuff. I mean, wow.
You know, just to put this in perspective, you were talking about the most lucky people on the planet right now are government workers, their jobs secure, and then a lot of them have pensions. I have a government client who retired on a pension of $125,000. And I was telling her how lucky she is, because if I was to get her salary, I would need $8 million invested in 30-year treasuries to get what she's getting as a pension. And I don't know too many people that walk away from a company with an $8 million 401k.
And I don't know how many politicians that ever even discuss this particular aspect ever. In fact, throughout this whole shutdown, they're the ones that are still working. All our politicians here are working. They're getting paid full time. This is not our area, because we're not going to be able to resolve this. But what I can say is that there are a lot of people now, and one of the things that I think that listeners might be interested in, I wouldn't be trading this because it's very light volume, but as an indicator, the IAI, the iShares Broker Dealer Index, it's trading at 57. It had a high of 72 back in February, had a low of 42. I would not be surprised if there a lot of people, and I think I saw a statistic recently that some of the brokerage houses have never seen such an influx of people being interested in the market. I suspect that this could be part of the next phase if there is a nice rally into year end, even if we have a bit of a consolidation through the summer, and people will be looking at this and saying, you know what, I'm going to trade the market. And I think that's what we're seeing. And if this IAI breaks to a new high above 72 in 2020, I think it's telling us something's going on that is really important. And I think it would be a very bullish sign. In fact, even at 57, if we can get to the 65 area, that would be really good action. So there are certain key aspects that I'm looking at, key indicators or sectors, and this is one. And I think it's telling me a story. Look at how it's held. Who would have thought with no fees, the IAA, the brokerage dealer index, could go from 42 up to 57? So I think that's a sign, at least for me. It's right at the 200 period moving average in the weekly charts. It's at resistance, but to me, it's a bit of an indicator. So I think there are a number of key little just triggers that I would have. If the IAA pulls back and goes under 52, I say, whoops, now we've got to be really careful. If the Dow breaks under 22,000 over the next few weeks, I say, uh-oh. If the QQQ, this is real simple for me, the QQQ at 231 high just today, in fact, 232.13 was the high today. If it starts to trade under a trend line that I'll show in the chart, if it closes under 219, I'd say, whoops, we're in for a bit more of a, not just a pullback, but a deeper correction. So I have levels that I'd be looking at, but so far we've seen something really unusual in such a short period to have any index get back to almost its all-time high under these conditions. That's impressive. And it is saying that working at home might be a factor here, because these stocks are showing a lot of strength, have shown a lot of strength. So you can't just dismiss this is the 1930s. I don't remember seeing, when I went through the different charts and sectors from the 1930s, very few just independently went up like this. So this tells me that you can't ignore it. Something very positive is happening. And so those are the levels that I'd watch. And certainly if the QQQs break to a new all-time high above 237.47, that is very positive.
Yeah, I wonder how much of this, as we were mentioning, with yields on a two-year Treasury note at 15 basis points, and you take a look at some of these Dow stocks. These are high-quality companies, Basil, with dividend yields from 3 to 5%. You just don't see that at a time when 30-year Treasuries are at 1.4. So it may be we see this rotation you're talking about.
Yeah, so putting that into perspective, you know, fund managers, the summer period, we're just about to kick off the summer period, slowish trading, but I would not be surprised if there are a lot of fund managers out there saying, you know, I can't buy these tech stocks at this level. That's just, even if it's in my charter to be able to do it, I'd much prefer, look at the Merck trading at, you know, 76. I'm not saying this is the one. I'm just saying, as an example of what you're talking about, a great company, you know, in a bit of a pullback here. But what, yeah, good dividend. So I would not be surprised if money starts to flow into other sectors very selectively, maybe like a Raytheon, or it's called Raytheon Technologies now. You know, there are companies that have done very well historically at the lower end of the spectrum. You know, going Caterpillar, you know, going from a high up in the 170s at one point down to under 90, and now it's trading at 160. This is a great company. So, yeah, I think that they're going to be stocks to look at that are not the high techs, and maybe it's going to be very selective. But I do think there's a chance that the summer represents some kind of a rotation, and at the same time is telling us what's building for the next big move, maybe in September. But it also allows us to say, well, let's look at something else. And I think that that's really what's happening here. And that's not to exclude an Amazon. I was mentioning the other day in my show that if you look at the retail index, if you look at the RTH, the RTH looks fantastic. It is just within points of its all-time high. What is that? That's the Van Eck Vectors Retail ETF. But wait a minute. Someone will say, no, wait, I've got the retail ETF. You say, well, what's the symbol? And they say it's called the XRT. And then you say, wait. The XRT is the S&P Spider Retail. That's at the lower end of the spectrum. Why? Because the RTH has Amazon. And I think that's really summing up what we're talking about. Tale of two cities, in this case, a tale of two sectors within the same title, retail, One has Amazon and one doesn't.
All right. Well, listen, Basil, as we close, if our listeners would like to follow your work, you have a newsletter. You also have a podcast. Tell them how they could find out more.
So I have a daily newsletter. It's called The Opening Call. It's very comprehensive, and I show the charts. I show the Chaffee-Weig methodology every day. And we also we look at anything that moves, I'm prepared to look at. And that's what we put in the newsletter. And at the same time, I have the Tiger Technicians Hour is on Tiger Financial News Network. I have the noontime slot. That's noon Eastern time to 1 p.m. And it's called the Tiger Technicians Hour. It's a call-in show, and I'd love to take people's calls. And that's at tfnn.com. You'll find me. And that's every market day, noon to 1 p.m.
All right, Basil, thanks for coming on the program. Hopefully you'll get back to playing tennis as they open things up.
I certainly hope so, yes.
Okay, take care.
Thank you, Jim. I appreciate that. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
China undertook their digital currency project about 5 years ago. So in 2014, they introduced something called the DCEP project, the Digital Currency Electronic Payments Project. And it was really in 2019, last year, when those efforts seemed to accelerate, when Facebook introduced the concept of Libra. And recently, in April of this year, China piloted their digital currency in 4 cities. And officials have said that they would like the currency to be in ubiquitous domestic use by the Winter Olympic Games in Beijing, which are slated to be held in 2022.
To hear this full interview with Aditi Kumar on how China has launched the first shot in the digital currency wars and what this means for the future of the global payment system, go to financialsense.com and hit the subscribe button.
One of the asset categories that's doing well in 2020 has been precious metals. It's been primarily gold, but here in the last week, we have silver starting to break out. How far does it go? Do we take out the old records that we saw in 2011, or is this just merely a short-term rally? Let's look at the facts, the fundamentals. Joining me on the program is Jeffrey Christian, founder and president of CPM Group, and Dave Morgan from the Morgan Report. Dave, I want to start this out with silver, because if you go back to this year, one of the things that we've seen is gold has been on uptrend and the stocks have begun to follow the metal. That's something we haven't necessarily always seen. But up until probably the last couple of days, silver has been lagging behind. So let's begin with silver. First with you, Dave, your take on silver as it's breaking out as we speak.
Well, silver, I think, has disappointed precious metals investors for quite some time. I'm on record as saying that the low for this long-term bull market, I think it's, we're still in a secular bull market, took place in December 2015. And for a while, I was correct. It's true on the gold side, the 1150 print or thereabouts for gold was the low, and gold continues to make good progress, but silver recently hit the $12 handle and moved up substantially from that point in time. On top of that, we saw a gold-silver ratio that's never been recorded in all of recorded history of approximately 125 to 1. Now, as we're speaking today, it's dropped all the way down to 100 to 1, which is certainly a large gold-silver ratio by historic means. It's only been there twice before. But nonetheless, it's a drop from the 125 level we experienced very recently. I think we're starting to see silver move, and I think you asked the right question, Jim. Is this a short-term move, or is this something that's going to move up and down like all markets, but the general trend will be much higher, and are we going to get back to what we saw at the beginning of May 2011 or not remains to be determined. I'm still relatively bullish. I do think that there has to be a psychological change, which I want to address right now, in investors' minds for silver to actually get to, let's say, the previous highs. And whether or not that will take place or not remains opinion only at this point. As I like to say, following the great Richard Russell, the market knows more than any of us. So turn it back over to you.
You know, one thing that I learned from both you, Dave, and Jeff, and let's contrast gold to silver. Silver has many aspects on the industrial side, from all the modern devices we have, from cell phones to iPads to laptops. And Jeff, you know, at one time, a good portion of silver came from scrap, from film, but now in the digital world, that isn't the case. But a lot of silver is consumed. And now it's part of our electronics. You know, they put it in solar panels, our cell phones. But I don't know if you're seeing a lot of scrap come from a cell phone. Is there enough silver to do that? So I wonder, Jeff, if you would talk about the supply and demand for silver.
Yeah, it's interesting because, you know, yeah, silver use in photography is not gone away, but it's a fraction of what it used to be. And silver recovery from photography is a fraction of what it used to be, too. So you've lost on both the supply and the demand side on that. You talked about how silver is consumed in a lot of applications. And I think it's important to understand it's not. It's actually used in a number of applications, and that silver is recoverable. It is recoverable from cell phones. You wouldn't recycle the cell phone just for the silver, but it's got gold, it's got sometimes platinum and palladium in it. It's got other things that are recoverable and recyclable. And in many jurisdictions now, there's a law that says you recycle end-of-life electronic products. So the silver is coming out of cell phones and computers and all those other electronic appliances that use it. And you are seeing a fair bit of secondary recovery in silver. It's down probably a third from where it was in 2011, 2012, when the price was $30, $40 an ounce. But it's still pretty high. Mine production has been basically, well, it rose into about 2015, 2016. And then with the bear market across mining, not just silver and gold, but also copper, lead, and zinc, which produce a lot of byproduct silver, you've seen silver mine production fall about 10, 12%, I think, over since 2016. It was about 820 million ounces in 2016. Our estimate is about 760 million ounces last year, and it's probably going to be off another, you know, 25, 30 million ounces this year, partly because a number of mines have been closed down, at least for a time, due to the global lockdown over COVID-19. So you put that together with about 200 million ounces of various secondary supply, old scrap, old electronics, and you come up with, you know, about 960 million ounces of total supply. And fabrication demand, which is really what you want to measure supply against, was about 926 million ounces last year. So you had a relatively tight market. You had about a 36 million ounce surplus. And I think one of the issues that you've seen in the silver market is that investors have really pulled back from buying a lot of silver over the last 4 or 5 years, and especially the last couple of years. And so that 36 million ounces, while it's not a big surplus, it was enough to weigh on the price of silver. Now, if you look at the price of silver, it's been trading basically between $14.50 and $20 since the second half of 2014. And you saw a period in late 2019 into January and February of this year where the price was basically trading, you know, $18, $19, even $20 an ounce. But it's come off from that, and now it's starting to come back up. So when I look at the increase in the silver price over the last day, really is what we're talking about, the last 3 days. The price is going back to where it was in the period October, November, December, January, February. And I don't necessarily see it extending that initial. Ultimately, you know, several years from now, I think the silver price could go much higher. But I think that right now the silver price probably will be hard-pressed to break over $19 or $20 on a sustained basis.
Let me ask both of you. I know that gold, I can't think of any technician I have had on my program over the last year that hasn't been bullish on gold. Has that transferred into buying gold coins like gold eagles, gold bars, compared to, let's say, what's going on the silver side, either one of you?
I'll start, Jim. So I agree. I do technical work. I don't base the Morgan Report totally on technical analysis, but I was pretty heavily trained in it. So kind of to reiterate probably what you're sick of hearing, Jim, but the 1550 level is critical. We finally broke through that. I think it took 6 years or so. Jeff may correct me, but once we got through that, then we had another level. And basically, technically, gold looks very positive. We are seeing what I call the psychological effect that really never leaves gold. It ebbs and flows. Sometimes it's low, sometimes it's high, but it's always a way to preserve wealth. It's almost a guarantee. hedge against the economic system at large. It's something that I think Jeff, as well as anyone on the planet, has actually done some of the best analysis showing that a really balanced portfolio holds a larger percentage of gold than most professionals are willing to admit. Did that at the Silver Summit a few years back. I think the number, if I remember correctly, was drawn from analysis from 1968 onward. I think it was a 25% weighting to gold, which is, you know, right on up there. So it's very important, but silver technically is very difficult to look at. And it is doing well, as Jeff said, the last 3 days. And I actually agree with him here that if it's just now touching into what I call an indecision pattern or a channel formation that held for several months, as Jeff mentioned, and the top of that channel is around the $19 level. And I've had several interviews over the last couple of weeks. People said, you know, when's silver going to go? And I say, after it goes above 1850, and it stays there and moves upward from there. And I will have to say, based on the commitment of traders and the amount of market participation, it could do it, but I'm not holding my breath here. It is good to see it move and move robustly, which it does. It's nice to see it outperform gold on a temporary basis. Whether this is sustained or not, again, remains to be determined. So, Jim, I think we've got to see the 1850, I'll stick to my number, and we've got to see it really gain some momentum. If you look at what's happening, it's always, from my studies for years, based on monetary demand or investment demand. And when people, some percentage of people, look at silver the same way they look at gold as a wealth preserver or a wealth builder or a safe haven, once that comes into the market again, then you're going to see more sustained moves in the silver market that hasn't happened yet, with the exception of Scott Maynard, who was interviewed at the Davos meeting not too many months ago and was asked by Bloomberg what was his number one go-to investment for 2020, and he said silver. And I think the Bloomberg guy almost fell off his chair. He said, silver, why not gold? And Scott said, well, gold's pretty near its all-time high, but silver is way undervalued relative to gold. And then the interviewer asked him, well, do you think it could do something? He meant palladium. He didn't use the word. Could it do something parabolic like the palladium market? And Scott actually said, I think it's a possibility. So there's someone out there in the investment community that's very knowledgeable and what I would say probably in the upper echelon that is positive to silver market. And if you look at the flows into the ETFs, they've been rather significant. So I think investment demand is coming back to silver, and that's the driver. And, you know, if you could tell me ahead of time how much that investment demand is going to take off in 2020, I could give you a lot better projection of what the price profile would look like.
Jeff, are you seeing a lot of coin buying come into the gold market? In other words, we've seen GLD move. I know a lot of hedge funds move in and out of that space. What about coinage buying?
That's one of the biggest concerns that we've been talking about really for about 9 months now. You saw the gold price start rising in late June of last year and the silver price too. And if you look at what was going on really starting in late June, but even up until now, most of the buying that you've seen that has propelled gold and silver prices higher has been in futures, options, forwards, and ETFs. And not just the ETFs that buy physical metal, but also the leveraged ETFs. You've got a lot of short-term, technically driven, opportunistic investors who are taking advantage of what they see as positive chart patterns, and they're buying silver and gold derivative products, you know, futures, forwards, options, and ETFs, and they're not necessarily buying physical gold and silver. The physical investors who buy gold and silver because they're worried about the state of the world and they're worried about their own, you know, economic and political and social well-being, they have been largely absent the gold and silver markets the last couple of years. They came back in a spurt in March as the global lockdown emerged, but that was a flash in the pan. And in April and in the first half of May, there hasn't been a lot of follow through in the physical demand. And you know, so what you're seeing is gold and silver prices rising based on short-term buying in the futures and ETF markets. And you're not seeing the kind of long-term physical demand in for gold bars and coins that would suggest a more sustained upward move at this time. We think that they'll come back at some point because we think that economic and political conditions will get worse from here. But until we really see a sustained return of physical demand for gold and silver from investors, we're not convinced that you're going to see silver, you know, significantly over $19 or gold significantly over $18, $18.20.
Let me get back to silver and even gold markets. So basically, Jeff and Dave, what's moving the gold and silver markets? A lot of our professionals, hedge funds, using derivatives like GLD, SLV, the futures market. And I know, Dave, there was a period of time in silver, and Jeff, where in the last decade, for the longest time, you saw silver trade between 3 and 5. At 3, they would go long in the futures market. At 5, they would go short. If I look at a chart over the last couple of years, it's almost like you're in that same trading range in the 14, 15 to the, let's say, upper 18 and 19 range. And that seems to me that complies with what you're saying about the pros that are like hedge funds that are usually trading these derivative products. Any comments?
No, I think you nailed it. I mean, one thing that very seldom is really mentioned, and you know, I think we all agree that the physical market could take command. I mean, palladium is a perfect example of that, is that in almost all cases, there's always been enough silver, regardless of your views on the derivatives market. I mean, there's always a physical market in both the metals. And at times, there's been a logjam. I mean, there's been times where the mint hasn't, you know, produced the demand that was at hand, usually on a temporary basis, a month or two maybe. And even in those cases, someone that wanted, let's say, silver eagles in an example, could usually move over into a silver round or maybe another government mint or something like that. So the physical demand for not only monetary purposes, but for industrial use as well, has been met by the market, by and large, the whole time. And again, the only exceptions are really on the retail side. Even in the 2008 financial crisis, what we saw was a big spread in premiums that we're seeing again. But that was a retail side. And I wrote an article about an arbitrage opportunity. And most people that follow me thought that I was going to go along with what I'll say the herd of the minuscule silver market, meaning that, you know, the silver price would match the 30% premium that the retail coin and small bar market had. And I said, no, it's going to go the other way. You're going to see these premiums come back to normal. You know, I think you're going to see that situation again. I think a lot of these dealers that are out there on the retail side, although the wholesalers are having some issues, according to people I could call like A-Mark and others at that level, which are pretty high up, are moving their prices up. Even the Mint increased their premium to primary dealers by 17% recently. But I think I've made my point. Regardless of your views on the derivatives markets and how much they control the price, if you get to the bottom line, is the physical metal there or not for purposes that are required for it, be it investment purposes or not, have been met in almost all cases for almost all conditions.
Let me throw something out that we've seen in the oil market, and that dealt with the ETF USO, which was buying futures contracts, which I don't understand retail investors going into something where a market is in contango. That's a nice way to lose money. But the interesting thing in May is USO had to sell a lot of their contracts at negative prices because they're used to just rolling those contracts over. Well, now, all of a sudden, there's not enough storage. So let me throw something out and just fast forward 3-5 years from now, where conditions on the monetary front and physical front get really, really bad and people start turning to the ultimate currency. Jeff, I want to go with you. Could you ever see a day where somebody's in the futures contract and they're in gold, most of that is just done for trading purposes? Could you ever see a situation where basically somebody says, you know what, I want to take delivery, and you get just the opposite of what we saw in oil, where the gold isn't there for delivery? Could that ever happen?
Yes and no. I mean, it's very funny because if you want to go back to like 1999, Goldman Sachs took delivery of a lot of gold on the COMEX in the August contract. And people were surprised that they did it. They said, why would they be doing that? Because there's plenty of gold. If you want to buy several hundred thousand ounces of gold, which is what they did at the time, it's very easy to do that in the physical market, in the spot market, in the forward market, and preserve your anonymity. So why did they use the COMEX? And the answer was because they saw a liquidity squeeze coming in the gold market in October with the October COMEX contract, and they wanted to broadcast to everybody in the world that, hey, if it comes to be late September and you need gold in New York, we've got it. So you can have that kind of short-term congestion in the COMEX, but there's so much gold and silver out there that can be delivered into the COMEX that it would only be a short-term event. Now, you saw this again in March. You know, the reality is that the amount of gold and silver stored in London is at record levels. There's, you know, the amount of silver that is held in vaults, registered vaults and reporting vaults, has risen more than 20% in London from 2016 through the end of last year. And the same is true for gold. You've got this historically high amounts of gold and silver stored in London, in Zurich, and in the New York market. So there's plenty of physical gold around. The problem in March that we saw was that the gold is in 400-ounce bars, and it's not readily available to deliver into the COMEX, which takes 100-ounce bars or 3-kilo bars. So you can have this congestion, but if it persists any amount of time, you start having those 400-ounce bars converted into kilos or 100-ounce bars, and you resolve that. So you could have congestion in the COMEX, where somebody says, let me take delivery of gold on the COMEX, but it can't last because there's so much physical gold and silver around to meet that. Then you have to say, okay, so if somebody really wants to take delivery of gold and silver for long-term economic or investment purposes, they wouldn't use COMEX. So if you saw somebody come into COMEX and say, no, I want to take that gold or silver, you have to say, well, what's your economic reason? Because you're going to be paying such a high premium for COMEX delivery compared to what you can get in the physical market. You know, so are you trying to screw around with the COMEX, or are you trying to build inventories of gold and silver? Because if you're going to build inventories of gold and silver, you're going to do it in the dealer market where you'll get a better price. So if you're going to come into the COMEX and say, I want to take delivery of undue amounts of metal that cause the price to rise, you're going to have to explain yourself to the COMEX and to its various committees and to the regulators, because they're going to say, well, this doesn't make economic sense.
So let's look at this going forward, what demand might look like for both precious metals. The 2007-2009 financial crisis, we saw things that we never saw before. The Fed's balance sheet grew from roughly about $800 billion to $4.6 trillion. A lot of the money that the Fed created, people thought there was going to be hyperinflation. It didn't. If there was inflation, it was mainly in financial assets for the longest running bull market in stocks. Contrast that to where we are now. The Fed's balance sheet has grown by $2 trillion in 2 months versus if you take QE3, it grew by $1.6 trillion over 14 months. So if you look at where we're going this time around, we're in a unique situation in the sense that because of the lockdown, a lot of factories and supply have been shut down, especially with the supply chain in China. So you're seeing services, factory output being restricted. At the same time, the government is creating money. They're basically borrowing it. And then they're issuing checks. They're putting dollars into people's pockets, businesses, to spend this money. And it looks like there's no end to sight. The Fed, meanwhile, is backstopped, to my reckoning, just about every financial asset on the planet. So what would this mean in terms of inflation going forward? Because the last time, we really didn't see inflation other than maybe what you saw in the financial markets. Comments, anyone?
Yeah, Jim, I'm going to take a tangent on that. This is, I think, the most important point I can make individually, but it is broad-based. So going back in my history, I've done a lot of resource shows, but I've also done a lot of what I consider mainstream investment conferences like the Money Show. And I was there one time years ago. I basically made the argument you just made, but it was at a lesser level because even QE to me was rather alarming. It was nothing like what you just outlined. However, I brought this up. It happened to be a gentleman that was kind of the head of the certified financial planners. And he listened to me, and I could tell from his body language, he really didn't want to hear the story. And he probably knew it. He just didn't want to get participation from the CFPs to basically recommend a gold position. Well, I give you that background to say this. I have been, I wouldn't say inundated, but I have been approached by more than one where I've actually lectured here from my office to CFPs that are taking the gold market much more seriously than they ever have. And if you take the adjunct to that, it's the pension market. And there again, where no one wanted to touch basically anything I had to say about a hedge position in the precious metals, I'm getting interviewed, consultations, inquiries, and that type of thing. So this is the idea for me, at least, that, you know, 1% or whatever, and Jeff, I think, has a number of 0.02% of all financial assets in the silver market. I mean, it's rather small, laughably so. If you started moving a fair amount of money into those markets, the precious metals markets, regarding the reason you outlined, Jim, I think you could see a substantial move. And it is possible that you could get a situation where maybe not through the COMEX, but even through the dealer market, where you might see congestion that took place for a while. Because if some of these entities wish to actually go and touch their product, it could have a substantial demand. And actually, to go one step further, you know, I'm allowed to have my own opinion still. I think it's destined to happen. Now, how does it, you know, turn out? Is it similar to the 1980 high of January 21st? I would be inclined to say probably. I think you'll get, you know, exhaustion at some point, and you get that parabolic move, and everybody's brother-in-law's cat wants to get in the gold market, but there's only so many. But we are at a very low level, and professionals are starting to acquire much more from, you know, my little office perspective here with, you know, family offices and small hedge funds and some pension planners and some certified financial planners, but I've never had it at the level I'm having it now. So I just wanted to throw that out there, Jim.
I want to take a slightly different approach to your comment. You know, last year, and to some extent, late 2018, there were all these people who kept saying, oh, we're in an inverted yield curve. And that is, every time since World War II to 2008, an inverted yield curve has either coincided with or preceded a recession. Therefore, the world's going into a recession. And we were saying no. And in fact, we didn't have a recession because of the inverted yield curve. We had it because of the pandemic. The reality is, you touched on, the monetary changes that occurred in 2008, 2009, and going forward. And 10 and 11 were very important because you had the European debt crisis and you had the downgrading of the treasury too. That has changed the monetary system and the financial system in ways that means that everything that happened prior to 2008 is not a good precedent. So those people who were looking at a model that said, oh, inverted yield curves correspond with recessions, from World War II to 2008, they were looking at an obsolete model. And it's not just what happened in 2008, 2009 that was radically different from anything we'd seen before. Everything since that time has been radically different. And we're in a radically different system now with this massive monetary accommodation, massive fiscal sovereign deficits and growing debt. And those cause a lot of problems. I do think that what you saw over the last 10 years, what, you know, and we were telling people, no, all of that monetary largesse in 2008 through 2011 did not necessarily mean hyperinflation. And it didn't occur in general inflation. It occurred, as you said, in the equity markets and in bond markets. And I think that going forward, that is the operative model. So we've seen this massive monetary accommodation and this growth in fiscal deficits and debt. And I think that that will continue to cause inflation in financial markets, but not in general prices. General prices, I think, are facing disinflationary and deflationary conditions that are probably much more problematic than inflation. So I think that you're in a different financial system than anything that preceded 2008. And that means that all of these intermarket relationships are different now than that they were before.
Jeff, what about killing supply? I'm just looking at San Diego. San Diego had 231 deaths from COVID-19. Six were deaths that weren't comorbidities, but our unemployment rate is 28.5%. So when you have unemployment, you have economy contract, asset markets contract, that tends to be deflationary. But what about the businesses? I read, 551 bankruptcies, about 25 to one-third of the businesses are not going to come back, mainly small businesses and even some large ones, like you're seeing bankruptcies like Macy's, JCPenney's. What about that on the supply front?
Well, it's supply and demand. I mean, you know, it's terrible because some of the mainstream economists and models have said, well, you know, we'll probably spring back to 80% of our pre-recession conditions. That means that we're going to be 20% smaller than we were. And there's going to be a lot of companies that don't come back. Consumer demand for patterns for various goods and services are going to change. One of the things that's going to be very interesting to see, I mean, you know, when I was growing up, and you guys are probably about my age too, you know, most meals were taken at home. So you had a lot more of your discretionary household money going into food purchases for preparation and consumption at home, and going out was a treat. But, you know, by the late 1980s, it had shifted, and most of the food purchases were for food bought outside of the home and consumed outside of the home. That may shift back. So I think you're going to have a lot of shifts in the demand side, and you're going to have a lot of shifts in the on the supply side. In mining, I don't know that you're going to see big changes in the mining side. In oil and gas, you will continue to see big changes, not so much because of the demand destruction of the recession due to the lockdown, but because of the price war between the Saudis and the Russians that we saw in March, April, May. And I think that you've got some other structural changes in the energy market. In the agricultural markets, I think we've seen a lot of people all of a sudden realize that the fabulous growth in industrialization of agricultural production over the last 20, 30 years has kept food prices very low and has increased food supply at a low price beyond what anybody thought possible in the 70s and early 80s. But it makes the whole world very vulnerable to a handful of producers. So I think that if we're lucky, there will be efforts to diversify production of agricultural products in order to have a more stable supply chain. I'm not sure that that's going to happen because that would entail a tremendous amount of both intelligence and ethics on the part of governments and large corporations. And I'm not sure that we have sufficient supplies of either of those in either of those industries at this time to make it happen. But I think that you're going to see some major changes across the economy, both in terms of supply and demand, for all sorts of goods and services.
I want to throw some out. You talked about mining. Let's talk about the miners themselves. I know in the last run-up in the last decade, you saw a lot of dilution and foolishness that took place in the mining industry. Companies buying junior mining companies for ounces in the ground at ridiculous prices, over-dilution of the companies. How would you contrast the industry today compared to the last decade? That's my first question. A second question would be, it seems to me the fundamentals for mining have never been better. You're selling your product in dollars, which is going up against other currencies. Your labor costs are in depreciating currencies. And one of your biggest costs, which is fuel, is diesel. That's going down. So it seems like this is a good time for the miners to make money. So question number one, what's the difference between the mining companies today compared to the way they were running the last decade? And number two, the fundamentals for making money.
I'll start this one. And I'll start by saying there is a big difference. But I would think the answer to your first question is, unfortunately, I think the mining companies are run just as poorly now as they were over the previous 10, 20 years. And I don't think that any lessons have been learned. And I think they will continue to squander their opportunity. You are right that this is a really good time for miners in terms of selling your products in dollars and paying your input costs in depreciating domestic currencies. But I think that the mining companies will continue to overpay to buy other assets rather than focus on running efficient, profitable companies. The thing that's changed is outside of the mining industry. Institutional investors have gotten larger and larger with more and more assets under management, and they've shifted from investing in specific stocks to investing in index funds that are tied to the stocks. And they've also shifted from thinking about the returns and composition of their individual funds that they're managing and thinking instead about a company-wide asset allocation. And when you get to that level, all of a sudden, all of these fund managers who are getting bigger and bigger
and are under tremendous pressure from their investor clients for better returns because they've been underperforming until recently basic stock indices. All of these fund management companies are moving away from mining investments because the mining industry market capitalization is too small. If BlackRock wanted to buy 2% of its assets and put it into, if BlackRock wanted to put 2% of its assets under management into gold mining, it would have to buy 100% of the outstanding shares of the top 20 gold mining companies to get to that 2%. So BlackRock, the largest institutional investor, says mining's too small for us. And so do the next 25 asset management companies. And so what you're finding, the big change in the mining industry, is that the institutional investors that just gave them money to squander on acquisitions are disappearing as investors. And the mining industry is starved for capital just when it probably should be generating the capital internally.
Yeah, I think I agree with a fair amount of what Jeff said. There is an opportunity. I've only spoken to a few of the fairly significant producers where with this, I'll call rest period with the CV-19, have been able to kind of think about their production profile and where they have, let's say, three significant producers. One of those might be at the margin. They're all sustaining costs are roughly at this level that we're at now in the spot market. And when they return in full, it might be better board of directors decision just to leave that one alone and not bring it back online. So as we all know, what there's less of usually goes up in price. So if there's less silver mine this year, which is pretty much a given with the CV-19, and when we restart, whenever that takes place, that these companies have actually, some of them at least, taken a hard look at what's their mandate to produce at a profit and, let's say, tighten up from management, meaning that they get rid of the situations that really are not productive to the bottom line, you might see a contraction in the industry, not only because of this virus, but because of more efficiency in the market. Now, I have to agree with Jeff that a lot of them don't think that way, but with this reprieve, there are conditions that almost force it. I mean, there's some situations in one of the largest countries that produces silver where some of these people might not want to come back to work, or there's been problems with transportation issues or several other situations that could inhibit the, let's say, flow of product that was established prior to this incident. So I think you're going to see a contraction, partly because of better thinking about what the bottom line is on a given balance sheet of some of these companies.
So as you look at this from an investment perspective, I think given the monetary backdrop and the fiscal backdrop, it argues well for precious metals. Each of you, how would you be playing this? Jeff, you talked about a lot of the institutions are either in the futures market or derivatives like GLD or SLV, or they're going into indexes. Of, you know, they could be going in maybe a GDX or a GDXJ. How would you be playing this? Would you be doing it on the bullion side, actually owning this stuff in derivatives, or actually some kind of ETF? Jeff first.
I take the approach of spreading I have a diversified precious metals portfolio within a diversified investment portfolio. So I have physical metal, gold and silver and some PGMs. I will get involved in futures and options. I prefer options to futures, but then that's just my personality. To take advantage of short-term price moves. And then I also will invest in individual companies. But the individual companies, I mean, I'm not a large institutional investor. My view is that the precious metals mining industry traditionally has been financed by individual investors, smaller specialist fund management companies, and wealthy individuals. And I think that that's where they need to focus their attention. So being in that retail investor community, I tend to look for companies that are well managed and that define growth in terms of growth of profits, not growth of ounces or tons or pounds of material produced. I want to see a company that says, as Dave was saying, you know what? If I slough off some of these properties, I may be producing less gold in the future, but I'll be producing more metal. You know, I think it was 1990, we had a little table in our gold yearbook and it showed that Anglo Gold and Hemlo Gold had the same profits in that year, but Anglo Gold produced 10 times as much gold. Which company do you want to buy? You know, I wish that I could buy Gold Corp when Rob McEwen was running it, because it was one of the cheapest cost, most profitable companies in the gold business. And as it bought Glamis and Wheaton River and God knows what else, it became a very expensive, unprofitable company. You know, I would always take that smaller company that's churning out profits, that has management that defines success as increased profits and dividends, rather than a company that wants to build its empire so that the CEO gets a nice, bigger golden parachute when it's taken over.
You know, let me ask you about that in this kind of market. You know, if you take a look at the last 10 years, you look at the FANG stocks, people were paying upward premiums because for one reason, these companies were growing. Look at Amazon today. Look at Microsoft. Take a look at some of these companies like Google. They were growing. The one thing that really strikes me that some of the big leaders, as you just mentioned, that comparison with Anglo Ashanti, how's Barrick and how is Newmont going to grow? I mean, how do you replace 7 or 8 million ounces that you're producing when you go out and acquire somebody else? It seems like that's hard to fulfill. So if you're in a bull market, and I don't care, even if it's in the oil industry, you want somebody that's going to be able to increase their production, not just rely on the fact that the price is going to go up and that's where they make their money.
Yeah, extremely difficult, especially on the gold side. I mean, you know, I've talked to many geologists on this trek of mine, and many of them have made the same comment that the stuff they used to walk over and just keep walking that was uneconomic and they could care less about, they're mining today. I mean, I'm pretty much a believer in peak gold, but I also have a caveat because Jerome Smith made a huge boo-boo when he wrote all his books on silver, the economy, and gold. And that was a technological change that he didn't foresee. And so I have to be humble enough to say maybe there's a technology out there that isn't, you know, that I'm unaware of that will be there 2 years from now. I would comment, Jim, that, you know, I think you're going to see more robotics in the mining industry going forward. And a few of these startups and somewhat, let me say, speculative situations are talking about using AI in the mining industry. So, you know, I think Jeff's point is well taken. They really stagnated on their ability to be efficient, profitable, understanding, you know, what kind of business they're in. They're in a business to make profit like anyone else on the stock exchange. So that's the end of my comment.
And just a final comment, what is it about that industry that is so poorly run?
From my perspective, it's, as you said, overpaying. I mean, when the markets, it's, and I'm sure some of these people will be upset with what I'm about to say, but so be it. I speak my mind. When I was at one of the first conferences at the Silver Institute, Rothschild had one of their bankers there, and he basically talked about the industry as a whole and the commodity cycle. And he said, they always get it wrong. You know, when it's very low and you can't produce at the cost of the product, silver, gold, for an example, then you'll start to see money come in and get the industry going again. And then it'll go, you know, peak out. And at that time is when all of the majors are acquiring. It's just the opposite of what they should be doing. So I think that's about as succinct as I can say it, Jim. It seems that they're on the sine wave and they're always at the wrong side of the sine wave when they decide to invest a lot of capital into replenishing their reserves when they should be doing just the opposite. And that's a generality, and I know there's exceptions, but that's the general rule.
Jeff?
Hey, Dave's got it right. I mean, you know, there is a, and you know, in the defense of the mining executive, the counter-cyclicality is foisted upon them to some extent by their shareholders. Because when the price is down, these guys don't, no one's buying shares or giving credit to mining companies, and they have to contract. And then when the price is up and all of those assets have inflated values, there's as much money as they can possibly spend on acquisitions. So to some extent, they're like junkies, and the pushers are their shareholders who will give them money when the price is rising and not give them money when the price is down. You know, Bernard Baruch famously said, you know, somebody asked him how he made his money. He said, I buy straw hats in September and I sell them in May. And you being a value, and that's the definition of being a value investor. So I get very bullish on stocks when they're very low, and I get very bearish on them when they're high. And I tend to either sell their shares or I'll buy puts against the position if I want to keep the shares. You know, so I think that there's a variety of factors that are there. There's definitely the empire building aspect of it. I also would say And I don't know this because I don't follow other industries. The vainglorious nature that you see in some mining executives probably is not limited to the mining industry. Another thing I'd say is I'm absolutely astounded by the extent to which gold and silver producers don't know the markets for their products. I mean, if I gave a test to the typical CEO of a mid-sized to larger gold or silver mining company on the nature of the gold and silver markets, I think I know two or three executives who would pass that test. The degree to which these guys don't know the market, there's one CEO that I know in the gold business outside of China who has ever visited a jewelry company. When we were explaining sputter targeting and the 85% new process scrap that's generated when you use sputtering targets for your gold or your silver or your aluminum, I had to explain what a sputtering target was because none of the executives had ever been to a fabricating plant using gold. They didn't know what sputtering target is, even though this stuff might use half of the gold that's being used in fabricated products these days. The extent to which these guys don't know their own markets is absolutely astounding.
Well, on that note, as we look at the markets today, what would you be telling investors who want to get in the market? Would you tell them, as you're doing, Jeff, maybe start out with the bullion, maybe pick an ETF rather than individual stocks because you really have to know the companies and management and also the projects they're involved in, plus, you know, what's their cost per ounce? Would you tell them to do that? What would be your advice? I'll start with you, Jeff, and then you, Dave.
Well, yeah, my advice to a general investor, and my advice to investors depends on who the investor is, but my general advice is you should have some physical gold and silver. You should trade futures and options and bullion ETFs to take advantage of short-term price moves. You should not get excited when the price rises. You know, how many times have we seen the price of silver go from, you know, $14 to $18, $19, and all these guys are talking about $50 or $100 or $200 silver, and the next stop is $14.50. You know, when you see $18, $19, that's a great time to lock in your profits and look to reposition yourself when it gets back down to $14.50 or $15.50 or $16.50. You know, so take advantage of those shorter term moves. Don't believe all the nonsense that you hear about prices going to the moon. And, you know, I hate to say it, but yes, indexed investing on the equity side makes sense. And one of those problems that you're seeing with the institutional investors is those mechanical AI driven indexed investment funds are outperforming, consistently outperforming the humanly managed funds that look at fundamentals and macroeconomics. And, you know, you hate to say it because you like to think that fundamentals and economics matter. But the reality is if you're looking for long-term investment positions as a passive investor, that you don't want to sit there and follow these companies and study them and figure out what they're doing right, what they're doing wrong, those indexed funds make a tremendous amount of sense.
Yeah, similar. I mean, it's physical first. It doesn't have to be an overloaded position. There's the right amount, and that's kind of determined by the investor individually, but some tend to overdo it. I try to stress that you don't have to overdo it. And then I like the equity side. I really am passionate about it. So I break it down to a top tier, mid tier, and speculative section and throw funds appropriately. But I think that Jeff is spot on as far as, you know, most of the larger money is in the index funds. It's a lot easier. I mean, I don't know how many fund managers I've met over the years and, you know, they hear the argument about physical, but it's just so much easier to just, you know, hit the SLV button and buy and sell. And most of these guys are looking at, you know, swing trading or whatever. Certainly I do have two positions. I have one where I am in and out of short-term moves. And then I have what I call my core position, which I basically hold. And at times, and recently, by the way, I just said, you know, I like these companies and I'm buying puts because I don't really want to lose the company, but I have a feeling that we may be at that upper range here shortly. And because of that, I want to protect my position. So things similar, I probably focus more for the equity side. We do feature ETFs from time to time and even the options or futures markets, but primarily it's an equity side look at the market from the top tier where the bulk of the money is on down to some of the more interesting story stocks.
So as we conclude here, I think all of us are in agreement that at least the macro fundamentals would argue well for precious metals going forward, depending on your risk and what you could do. I think we all agree that physical metal forms a part of it. Jeff, you're doing options and some individual companies, but you're in the industry. Probably for most individuals, an ETF when it comes to stocks would be much better. As we close, why don't we, each one of you, tell our listeners about the services that you provide and how they could find out more about the companies that you run and your service, starting once again with you, Jeff.
Okay, well, CPM Group is a research consulting company. We do a lot of fundamental research across commodities. A lot of what we're known for are precious metals, but we also do specialty metals, energies, agriculturals, and other commodities and commodity investments in general. Our website is www.cpmgroup.com. We also have a Twitter account now, but I don't know what the name is. I'm embarrassed to say. And we have an email address called info@cpmgroup.com. And people can go to our website, cpmgroup.com, and read about us and get some free reads and see what we do and what services we offer. Or they can send us an email and say, tell me about yourself.
Dave?
I publish the Morgan Report. You can go to themorganreport.com. There is an About Us tab. You can read about the background of our team. I do consultations. We write a monthly precious metals. Actually, it's a resource letter. Right now, we're focused primarily on precious metals because that's what the market's telling me. However, we've been all over the resource sector, lithium, cobalt, copper, you name it. We have had those investments in the past. I also speak at investment conferences like Jeff. And the best place to get some free information is sign up for our free list on the main page and go to the blog. If you go to the blog, you could get more information on interviews like this and some of the writing that I do for the public domain.
Well, all right. Well, listen, Jeff and Dave, I'd like to thank you for joining us on this roundtable discussion with precious metals. And like I say, on the day we're speaking, silver looks like it's doing very, very well. Who knows where this will be, but looks to me, at least on the charts, that 18, 19 level is going to be a tough barrier. Gentlemen, thank you both for joining us on the program. Stay safe and come back and talk again.
Thanks, Jim.
Thank you, Jim.
Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the Financial Sense staff and do not take into account listener suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies mentioned in Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.